Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us again. I just got off the Skype phone with Hideaki Fujiki to talk with him about his new book, Making Personas, Transnational Film Stardom in Modern Japan. This came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2013. Now, as you'll hear over the course of the interview to come, this is a book that is simultaneously a contribution to how we understand modern Japan and stardom specifically, and also how we understand modernity as a kind of transnational process of co-production. And so the book takes us through successively a number of case studies, a number of different kinds of contexts, different forms of the circulation of images and discourse that lead us through a transition in the way that Japanese stardom was conceived from an early case where the film stars are sort of these figures called benshi who, with their bodies and their voices, physically narrate and guide readers through what at that time were silent films, to the end of the story where we have figures like Mary Pickford and Clara Bow, in addition to the emergence of some colonially modern film stars and some Japanese film stars who embody a completely different way of being an embodied vocal, imaged, discursive star. So it's a fascinating study. It's a very, very rich study, and we really just covered little bits and pieces of the narrative, but I think you'll get a sense from the interview to come of the overall arc of the book and of the story in terms of its major transformations from beginning to end. So if you are a film buff, if you're interested in the history of film and cinema, and if you're interested in simply the sort of history and conceptual study of modernity, or if you just really like histories of Japan, this is a book for you. So I hope you have a chance to pick up a copy of the book and read through it, and I hope you enjoy the interview to come. Thanks very much for listening. I'm here to talk with Hideaki Fujiki about his new book, Making Personas, Transnational Film Stardom in Modern Japan. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Hideaki, and thanks very much for navigating this really tricky time difference with me and for making time to talk with me about a book that I really enjoyed. So thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in my book, and it's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about my book. Thank you.
My pleasure. So, Hideaki, could you start us off by saying just a little bit about your background, and specifically, how did you come to decide to work on the history of modern Japan?
Yeah, actually, my field has been film studies. I completed my PhD at University of Wisconsin, Madison, and that was 10 years ago. But at that time, so my field is film studies, but when I decided the topic for my dissertation, I chose Japanese films. And then one of my interests is to historicize Japanese cinema and also contextualize films in the historical environment. So modern Japanese history is a kind of secondary topic for me. Film studies first, and then but of course I was really, really interested in the history, so I tried to combine the historical studies, especially Japanese film, modern Japanese history, with the films.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the really notable and really nice things about the book, is that the approach here to the focus of the book, which is a history of the transformations of Japanese film stardom in the early 20th century, is one that's very deeply contextualized historically. And so I really, as a historian, I really appreciated that element of the book.
So yeah.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit about how you came to that particular focus? Why Japanese film stardom specifically as an object, and why the early 20th century?
Why film stardom? Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, actually, so when I try to find a theme for my dissertation, I was struggling to find which topic was good, suitable for me. And the first I came up with is modernity. But the 10 years ago, well, even now, many film studies scholars are interested in the issue of modernity. And so I felt that I need to differentiate from my study from other scholars. And then while reading some literature in film studies, I found the star system or star studies are quite interesting and useful to look at history. And then more specifically, as I discussed in my book, I found the star system and stardom involving with many historical factors. There is social, political, economic, and cultural in the historical context. So I thought that if I analyze the stardom as a kind of system or the structure or process, I might also be able to think about the history itself. And in other words, stardom is a good material through which to examine the issues of modernity. So this is my primary, this was, yeah, my primary motivation to take the stardom as my topic.
Great, thank you. Now, you mentioned early on in the book that the book began in its earliest incarnation as a dissertation. So can you talk a little bit about that transition? Were there any major changes in the project and how you were thinking about it, how you shaped it, how you were writing it in the transformation between dissertation to book?
Basically, my book is based on the dissertation and I didn't change. I didn't make a major change from my dissertation. But yeah, I tried to shape up many aspects of the dissertation to publish it as a book. And because I have been teaching in Japan, I have had many opportunities to write in Japanese instead of English. And so some of the parts of this book have been published in Japanese. And actually, I first wrote the original book in Japanese.
Wow.
Yeah. So and so the in the process from my dissertation to this latest book, I have revised many times in both Japanese and English, but the basic body in itself hasn't changed. Probably the introduction has dramatically changed. I tried to show a wider theoretical perspective to approach the stardom in modern Japan. And also, I try to consider the readership of this book. So, many dissertations assumes the quite narrow readers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the at this point, I have tried to change, but otherwise, basically the same.
Great.
In terms of the body, yeah.
So the introduction of the book lays out some of the major kind of conceptual and theoretical frameworks that mm-hmm. the rest of the book is going to build on and assume. And so we've already talked a little bit about the approach being very deeply historical. You mm-hmm. also talk here in the introduction about the importance of using modernity as a kind of mm-hmm. analytic framework. And we'll talk about that. Can you maybe open by talking a little bit about that? In what ways for you is it important to use modernity as an analytic frame in the book? And perhaps how does your approach to modernity here importantly differ from some other approaches to modernity in modern Japan?
Mm. Yeah, that's a very, very important question. Sorry. Maybe it'll be helpful for us to understand this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. let me repeat once again. it'll be helpful to compare the modernity approach
mm-hmm.
with the nation-state approach, maybe we can say. previously, many studies of Japanese cinema is based on the national framework. And so the this kind of study tends to confine the Japanese films in the national boundary of Japan. And in other words, they tend to look over the relationship between Japan or Japanese films and films abroad or other countries or other areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So modernity, I thought, could help us to look at Japanese cinema not simply as national cinema, but to look at the interactions between Japanese context and global context. So, and also modernity or the level of modernizations are
mm-hmm.
Different, vary depending on the regions or areas or nation. So such kind of imbalance or unevenness can be observed through the lens of modernity. So this is a basic idea
mm-hmm.
I try to use the concept of modernity, you know.
Thank you so much. And one of the really striking things about the book is that it does take a very explicitly transnational approach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's transnational not in the way that would propose a kind of simplistic American, for example, influence that was passively accepted or dealt with mm-hmm. by Japan and Japanese mm-hmm. audiences, but rather a very active co-production and a very active fashioning of this very transnational modern film culture mm-hmm. in a way that really was not reducible to a kind of East-West binary or mm-hmm. a West-Japan binary. So that's one of the really wonderful and very striking things, I think.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this is one of the important points I wanted to make. Yeah.
Well, that's really clear. So I think, well done.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So after we move from the introduction, we get into a series of four parts of the book that each treat a particular aspect of the development of film stardom and the film star system as it emerged and changed from about the 1910s through the 1940s. So the first part of the book looks at early Japanese film stars, and it mm-hmm. focuses mainly on Benshi. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Benshi, great. Benshi, and on a particular figure, a particular Japanese film actor as well. So the first chapter sets the stage, and I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about this, because this really does lay a foundation for a lot of what's to come. So it sets the stage by looking closely at the history of Benshi, and these are Japan's first film stars. So mm-hmm. the idea here is that we need, at least as I understand it, we need to understand this early group of film stars in order to understand the character and the importance of the kinds of changes and transformations that come after this, right? So to start us off, can you explain for listeners, just kind of briefly introduce, who are these Benshi and what's important about their mode of performance that we need to understand their particular mode of stardom?
Mm. Yes. Who did you say who is?
Yeah.
Who was the Benshi?
I mean, for a listener who doesn't, okay. who's never heard this word and knows nothing about this, yeah. what did the listener need to know to understand okay. how to integrate this into your argument?
Yeah, and maybe there are several ways to explain about Benshi.
Sure.
So the Benshi is a voice performer. who is standing on the side of the screen or sometimes sitting on the side of the screen to give explanation or narration or dialogues for the characters on screen. Mm-hmm. Is it clear?
Yes, that's totally clear.
And so so probably as you know, early cinema, especially in generally before the 1930, most of the films were silent cinema, which means that film in itself didn't have sound. But instead of giving voices or sound through film in itself, someone was accompanied with the screened film, mm-hmm. gave sounds and voices. So the sometimes orchestras played music on the side of the screen. And so Benshi was the person who explained the ongoing moving image. But the style of the Benshi, there are several styles of Benshi performances. And that styles, yeah, of course, the styles are different individually. Depending on the individual Benshi, but also the styles change over time. especially from the 1910s through 1920s or early 30s.
I mean,
yes.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. That's great. I sort of, when I was reading this part of the book, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but I've imagined them as a kind of early Japanese version of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen this? Sci-fi. Anyway, so it's a really striking, kind of way of thinking about the interaction between a speaking body and a film. And so the first chapter begins the story of this long transformation of Japanese film stardom by taking us through the kind of height of the popularity of these benshi, which changes in 1917 as they become institutionalized.
Right.
So they become supervised under the Ministry of Education and the Home Ministry. And this institutionalization kind of ironically also marginalizes them.
Yeah.
Right? So they become increasingly marginalized. And the chapter is really a fascinating window into this that also is for listeners who may not immediately know that the book does this, it's also a really interesting way to approach a history of bodies and embodiment, because you talk here about the importance of the bodies and how they use their bodies to a benshi performance, and how this really kind of changes with the arrival of talkies in the 1930s. So after this, we move to a chapter that looks at a particular famous early Japanese film star. And this is Onoe Matsunosuke. Now, he was cast, as you put it, in more than 1,000 films, which is kind of a number that's kind of, you know, for me, and I'm sure for a lot of listeners, difficult to even conceptualize, you know, acting in more than 1,000 films. Now, he becomes a set piece through which we understand sort of transformations, some important transformations in the sort of early stardom of Japanese film actors. So could you introduce him for us? What do we need to understand about Onoe Matsunosuke in order to understand why, like, his importance to the argument that you're making in this part of the book?
So I discussed the Onoe Matsunosuke as the most representative early star or the star and the star in early cinema, Japanese early cinema. And so, but he was enormous popularity. I wanted to discuss him. Especially because he represented some of the important characteristics of early type of cinema, film star. And he came from the low rank kabuki theater. Actually, there are two types of kabuki. One is the more rich, legitimate and prestigious kabuki, but the other one is low rank kabuki. And so he came from the latter, the low rank kabuki theaters. And so the so one of the interesting point is that the connection between the theatrical stream and Japanese cinema. And early Japanese films were strongly connected with theatrical tradition. So Onoe epitomizes such connection. Then the star, some characteristic of his stardom took over some aspects of theatrical star. So I wanted to highlight this aspect. But on the other hand, he was also important in that he mediated the relationship between theater and films. He So he was not only influenced by the theaters, but also he kind of invented the filmic representation or presentation of himself as a star. So we can observe the interaction or mediation of theater and cinema through looking at him as a star. So, yeah.
Great, thank you. And that's really helpful. And the chapter mm-hmm. also talks about a couple of other central themes that I'll just mention for listeners without going mm-hmm. into detail, just so that they know it's there. The chapter also talks about, in much of the same or in a very similar way to what you just mentioned, this kind of dual persona of the mm-hmm. early film star that he embodied, right? The sort of a virtuosic persona and also mm-hmm. a great man. And also mm-hmm. you talk here for listeners who are interested in business and sort of the way business history and theater and theater yes. and film history are related. You talk mm-hmm. about the importance of a troupe based corporate business model uh-huh. and the ways that that actually transforms stardom and shapes yeah. the stardom. So that seems like a really important point in this
yes.
book.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay. So after, yeah. So we could talk a whole lot more about that, but I'd like to also, like, let's get to mm-hmm. some of the other parts of the book. Mm-hmm. So after this first part of the book, we move to part two, and this is a part of the book that analyzes the film stardom of American film actors, mm-hmm. images of them, and sort of images become really important in a way we'll talk about in a moment. Images of them gained currency from the mid-1910s, and this chapter looks at that process. Mm-hmm. Now, chapter three takes us into a lot of different aspects of this. It first introduces the formation of a what you call a strategic star system in the U.S., mm-hmm. and then it looks at the ways that the circulation of visual images and also discourses of these American stars in Japan became crucial to their stardom. So mm-hmm. you take us into the example of Mary Pickford mm-hmm. And talk about the sort of how Mary Pickford is taken up and understood as a star and the implications of this for understanding stardom in Japan. So could mm-hmm. you maybe talk a little bit about that as a way of kind of helping us understand this larger point about circulation of images and discourses, perhaps?
Yeah. Actually, there are so many things I want to talk about. This.
Whatever you'd like, whatever you'd like to mention, whatever yeah. you find most interesting, that'll be best for us.
So the fundamental, the most fundamental interest I had is the I wanted to discuss the Japanese film history not as the confined Japanese border, as I said, but the I wanted to highlight the transnational aspect, as I mentioned very early in this interview. And so the film, or especially image, is not restrained by the language. Virtually everybody can share the image beyond the borders, like national border, right? So I wanted to pay attention to that aspect, especially because I discussed the film, which is different from language. So the this is the basic assumption I had at that time. So and in fact, the image circulation of American films or American star was enormously influential in the 1910s and 1920s in Japan, as I described in my book.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not so a simple process of circulation. As I also discussed, the Japanese critics and audiences interpreted the circulation of the American films and images and expressed their opinions and feelings in through the publications or magazine, film magazines, for instance. So I discussed in my book that these discursive practices are valued or make sense of the American films. And so through this process, American film stars enormously influenced the Japanese film history. So this is the basic things I wanted to discuss through these two chapters.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Now, one of the things that becomes really interesting and really important in this part of the book, in these two chapters, chapter 3 and chapter 4, mm-hmm. is that you show us by looking at the case of Mary Pickford, by looking at the sort of the literary production of some critics like Tanizaki, mm-hmm. by looking at other kinds of sort of images that emerge out of this, you talk about the way that a new kind of stardom, a new kind of star persona emerges from this transnational co-production. Mm-hmm. This is a persona where the sexuality mm-hmm. of the stars becomes really important and becomes emphasized. And this becomes a matter of, you know, some debate. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that aspect of what's going on? Because that continues to become important, or continues to be important, rather, throughout the book, this identification or not of the kind of sexuality of stars with their persona and with stardom.
It would be easier to talk about the chapter 5 or 6, the chapters in which I discuss the Onnagata.
Sure. Okay.
And female and and the actresses.
Okay, sure.
So if I, that would be easy to talk about your concerns.
Sure, no problem. So what I'll do is I'll just kind of, in order to get us there, just sort of set out for listeners how we get there.
Mm-hmm.
So early in this part of the book, in part two, it sort of, the book lays the foundations for understanding these kinds of transformations that are going to take on special salience in like chapter 6 and 7 when you talk about mm-hmm. this figure of the mm-hmm. Onagata, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Right.
And one of these issues that comes up is the increasing sexualization of mm-hmm. especially sort of figures of the American star. And you talk about the idea and discourses that associate the kind of physique and the expressions of American actors' bodies as more natural in some way.
Right.
So that becomes something that sets the stage.
Yeah.
Then after a discussion of the kind of the cultural values and ideologies that go hand in hand with this promotion of American film stardom, the images and discourses thereof, in terms of gender and class and aesthetics in chapter 4, this then takes us into part 3 of the book, which is where you're leading us. And part 3 looks at the ways that this circulation and co-production of Japanese and American forms of stardom really transforms Japanese film stardom in really interesting mm-hmm. ways in the early 1920s. Okay, mm-hmm. so let's jump from there to then one of the important chapters in this part of the book, which is chapter mm-hmm. 6, which looks at the the figure of what's called an onagata, mm-hmm. and the replacement of this figure with actresses, with other kinds mm-hmm. of film actresses in the 1920s.
That's right.
Okay, so now that I've set that up, thank you for your patience. Thank you for your patience with my yakking as I do this. Can you, for listeners then, as a way to take us into what you want to say about onagata, can you first perhaps explain, for listeners who aren't familiar with the term, what yeah. is an onagata? And then sort of talk about whatever you want in terms of what you wanted to talk about.
Okay. So the onagata, maybe many of the listeners know that onagata comes from kabuki tradition. And so that is the male actors who plays the female characters or female roles. And so the since the 17th century, when kabuki was established, kabuki used kabuki has used the onagata instead of female actresses. And then the Japanese films was influenced by this practice until 1920. So in other words, around 1920, that practice dramatically changed. After 1920 or after 1919, most of the Japanese films began to use actresses instead of onagata.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is quite a peculiar characteristics to compare to film practices in other countries. And so I found so many interesting phenomena in this transition from the onagata to actresses.
So what were some of the most interesting phenomena in that transition for you? Like what are some of the aspects of that transition that you're most excited about? Well, for example, we talked about this issue of the sexuality of the actor,
that's right.
and the idea of naturalness.
Yeah.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
This is related to the my discussion in earlier chapters. In this interview, we already discussed the influence or circulation of American stars, right? And the critics valued the representation of American stars. And so the transition from the onagata to actresses was inextricably connected to this historical phenomenon. So one of the important aspect is that Japanese critics paid particular attention to the body, physical body of actresses in American films.
Mm-hmm.
And then they recognized the difference between American actresses and onagata in the 1910s. And then they valued American stars over Japanese onagata. So my basic assumption is that onagata emphasizes more his performance than the physique in itself. And then, so, but yeah, I assume that discursive valuation of American star, especially American star's body, was powerful to change the Japanese convention of onagata to the actress.
Right. And this is actually one of the another way that I think the book speaks really productively to a history of bodies. Because one of the things, so early on in the book, and in the third chapter, I think, you make the point that as images and discourses of American stardom start entering into circulating and being kind of transformed in the context of Japan, one of the things that's emphasized is the naturalness of American actors.
Right.
So when we get to chapter six, one of the things that happens, at least, and tell me if I've got this totally wrong, is that the onagata, who had been men who played the roles of women, they become less, they kind of give way to actresses as stars, in part because the kind of actress's sexuality is praised as more natural, right? Defined in terms of the coherence between a kind of the sex of the body and the gender of the role being performed. And this really comes from an engagement with this image of the sexuality and naturalness of the American film star. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you for your
No, I mean, thank you. The book is super clear on this, so you make it easy for me. That's one of the great things.
Yeah. So, but the actually, I tried to discuss the complexity of many, I mean, the connection of many elements. So that's why it's a little bit difficult to explain it.
No, I think
for a short term.
So one of the other things that before we move to the last part of the book, I just want to make sure we at least mention one of the other really important things that this third part of the book does, and that is you take us into a cinema company, and you show us in the fifth chapter the ways that this kind of restructuring of or this transformation of Japanese film stardom is not just about the circulation of discourses and images, but it's also about a deep structural change in terms of the institutions of film and the institutions of film stardom. So this is, you talk about various aspects of this in the fifth chapter. You talk about the Shochiku Kinema Company and that the ways that they really restructured the system in which actors were training and performing and being exploited. Do you want to maybe mention what are the most, for you, important or interesting elements of that part of the story that you would want to share with listeners?
As you mentioned, the the Japanese industry dramatically changed in 1920, and why change? It's important to look out in what ways the Japanese industry changed. It's a little bit difficult to explain about it in a short term,
you talk about the importance, for example, of actors being ranked according to how popular they were, how senior they were, right?
And
how
So
is there anything like that you feel like is really important for listeners to understand?
Probably the way of managing actors changed at that time. So the new So new companies like Shochiku and Kokkatsu and Taikatsu emerged in 1928. So these new companies explored a new way of managing actors. And this is greatly influenced by the American film industry or company, and because some executive members of these companies traveled to the United States to visit some studios. And so the there are many aspects, but one of the important aspects is that in the 1910s, when Onoe Matsunosuke was a distinguished film star, the number of actors were much more limited, much more small number of actresses played for films. But the since 1920, new companies attempted to hire higher number of actors and actresses, and then they hierarchized film actresses in terms of their popularity. And that popularity is based on the consumption of films and the film stars, right? And as I discussed in earlier chapters, Onoe Matsunosuke took over the tradition of Kabuki, and the Kabuki actors, Kabuki actors' ranking was not necessarily based on their popularities, but also the how can I say? I forgot the term I used. The special way of ranking based on the age or skills or the career.
Sure.
Right, and so this was not necessarily based on the popularity or capitalist way of evaluating the actors. So in that way, the new companies tried to manage on the basis of, say, maybe a capitalist principle more explicitly. And this is one of the important points I tried to make in this chapter. Yeah,
that's great. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that also that becomes a really important theme for this part of the book. And elsewhere in the same chapter, in a discussion of the kind of theorization and a new kind of theorization of film and acting by a director, Murata Minoru, you talk about the idea of actors being instruments. So an actor's body being like a musical instrument. And this part of the book, I mean, I think in concert with this emergence of a capitalist discourse that's infusing what's happening here, actors become not only instruments to be exploited, but they also become commodities. And we won't have time to really talk about this in detail, but Chapter 7 looks at the emergence of a Japanese actress, Kurishima Sumiko in particular,
yes,
right, as an example of the commodification.
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't speak
That's
English.
Good.
The commodification of Japanese actresses in the context of the rise of a consumer society. So that becomes actually a really important part of the book. Kind of labor history and consumer history is an important part of what's happening here.
Yeah.
So part four of the book, as we come to this last part, looks at the relationship between cinema stardom and modernity. Now, modernity and ideas of the modern have been, up to now, really part of the book from the very beginning, but part four really focuses in very explicitly on ideas of the modern and modernity as really important foci of the discussion, important concepts. This part of the book has two chapters, and these chapters focus on two different individuals, Clara Bow and Natsukawa Shizue. And it uses these cases to look at how film stardom involved the phenomenon of the modern. Both figures are explicitly associated with the language of the modern here. Now, both figures, Clara Bow and Natsukawa Shizue, both figures are modern girls and modern actresses, but they're very different ways of being modern actresses in very different ways. So this really, I think, productively breaks apart what some other studies treat as a kind of a fairly coherent and a fairly unproblematic single category of the modern girl. Right here we have very different ways of being modern girl. So to kind of just talk a little bit about this, let's start with Clara Bow. In what ways for you, or what are some of the most important ways for you that Clara Bow was a modern girl in the context of her film stardom in Japan? What was important about her modernity in the context of the film stardom in Japan?
Maybe before talking about Clara Bow, maybe my assumption about the modernity. As I mentioned, modernity, actually there are several aspects of modernity. One is that modernity as a critical, analytical term, but at the same time, modernity is important the modernity refers to the historical condition of the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, and so on. And so my very fundamental assumption is that modernity is multi-layered. Many different kinds of aspects are interrelated in this term, right? And so Clara Bow didn't represent all aspects of modernity. I assume. But as I mentioned, the critical discourse or fan discourse of the time identified Clara Bow as a representative figure of modernity. And they used a word modern or modern girl. And so in that sense, Clara Bow was a very important figure to epitomize the modernity. But again, in my book, I also assume that the star like Kirishima Sumiko, who was not referred to with the word modern, also epitomized some aspect of modernity. So, in that sense, Clara Bow was the single important figure. What was your question? Sorry.
Sure. This is great. This is actually, you've answered it. It's great.
I thought that I needed to clarify my assumption about that. Modernity. So, and then the Clara Bow. What's the question about Clara Bow?
So, Clara Bow, what I'm actually interested in bringing out for listeners here is the way that Clara Bow and Natsukawa Shizue both represented modern girls, but did so very differently. So in chapter...
That's why.
Right. So in chapter 8, you talk about Clara Bow being associated with the discourse of the modern girl in a very particular way. She's associated with flappers. The characters she plays are very sexualized. Yeah. She's very controversially modern, I think is the phrase. In contrast, Natsukawa Shizue is not controversially modern. She's respectively modern. So she's also a modern girl, but she's a modern girl in a very different way than Clara Bow. So maybe can you perhaps talk about, for you, what are some of the most important ways that Natsukawa Shizue differed from the modernity or the modern girlness of Clara Bow, and what's important for us to understand about that in order to understand the larger arguments that you're making in this part of the book?
Yeah, thank you. I suppose that a general image of modern girl is how can I say? It's controversial and mischievous. But I try to more closely examine that kind of characteristic of modern girls. And then I wanted to discuss the various different aspects the modern girls or the image of modern girls involved at that time. Mm-hmm. And so, as you mentioned, the on the one hand, there was a type of modern girl like Clara Bow, who was targeted as the controversial figure. But on the other hand, some actresses who were also called modern girls represented quite different meaning from the Clara Bow. Modern girls who are controversial. So I wanted to highlight these contrast images in modern girl. In other words, maybe there are two levels. There are different types of modern girls at that time. By the way, the modern girls were not not necessarily the concrete people. I mean, can I say they were discursively constructed, and so the number of the modern girls in reality was quite small, I think. But the through the print through the magazines and newspapers, other print materials, so the image of a modern girl was constructed. And then there are two types of modern girl images. On the other hand, I also wanted to highlight the connection between the modern girl figure or modern girl image with the governmental policy. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, the Natsukawa Shizue was regarded as a kind of respectable modern girl. In other words, quite conservative in a sense. And then So maybe, I thought that through analyzing the figure of Krishna Sumiko, I might be able to highlight the process of modern girl, I mean process of discipline that the image of the modern girl might have been transformed from the controversial figure to more disciplined image of modern girl, which fits into the governmental policy.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. And you talk about in chapter 9.
Yeah.
This is specifically contextualized just to for the historians of the audience, right, who might be especially interested in what you just said about the contextualizing this within government policies. You talk specifically about this emergence of this respectably modern girl, and for in the case of Natsukawa Shizue, in the context of a rise of consumerism, a kind of fashion or a vogue for Marxism, and kind of nationalistic aspirations. And this kind of the figure of the nation or the nation state and its connection with stardom. So the connection rather between the nation, stardom, politics, nationalism, this comes to a head really in the conclusion. So as we come to the end of the book and we come to the conclusion of our conversation, and I'm sorry that we're already at the conclusion because this is such a fascinating book, but you bring us from this figure of the respectably modern girl in this very nationalistic context in chapter 9 and bring us out into kind of a larger study or a more focused study of a figure who actually began the book, although we didn't talk about her yet, but we'll talk about her now. And this is the case of the actress Ri Koran, who's actually a Chinese actress, Li Xinglang. And she becomes really popular in 1939, and you talk about the emergence of her stardom in the context of colonial modernity. So by the end of the book, we have a specifically colonial context for this modern stardom in a way that I think really opens the study out potentially into lots of really fascinating directions that it could go from there. So, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today. I'm sure listeners already have a sense of how fascinating the book is, and also probably of how much there is in the book. Now, we only barely scratched the surface of what's a very, very rich study, and there's a lot that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you feel is important to mention for listeners, and maybe especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Okay, there are so many things I want to talk about. And, so as we have talked, modernity is one of the most important aspects in this book. And also I tried to highlight the many different aspects or dimensions of modernity. And then, as you mentioned, I refer to the colonial modernity in the conclusion. Maybe I should clarify this point.
Sure.
So from the chapter, the first chapter through the last chapter, I didn't discuss colonial modernity so much. And by colonial modernity, I mean that especially, I mean that during, before the World War II and during the World War II, Japan was a kind of empire to colonize Korea and Taiwan and other Hokkaido, Okinawa, and also semi-colonize the northern China and Southeast Asia, right? And then I wanted to take this issue for my study of film stardom, but I couldn't take pages for this matter in my book. But one of the reasons I didn't discuss this matter in this book is because there were little stars from other Asian countries during the 1920s and until the late 1930s. And maybe Rikoran can't be called a Chinese star because her parents were Japanese.
Right.
So virtually there was no stars from other Asian countries before the World War II, before the end of World War II. But this suggests that imbalance between Japanese stars and other Asian stars or actresses or actors. And this is so especially compared to the relationship between American stars and Japanese stars, or American influence and Japanese film history, right? This is what we discussed earlier in this interview. So such kind of imbalance or power structure, we might say, can be observed through looking at the stardom. So I wanted to highlight these uneven relationship, global relationships through the study of film stardom.
Great. Well, Hideaki, thank you so much. So now that the book is out, congratulations on the book. What's next for you? Are you working on any projects right now that you're particularly excited by?
Yeah, right now I have two big projects, maybe three big projects, but my own project, my own book projects are two. One of them is about audiences. Mm-hmm. But it's really difficult to discuss audiences, film audiences, I mean, especially because empirical evidence usually don't exist, are not so available about audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach is that I try to analyze the film audiences in terms of the concept or conception of social categories, like the masses, the people or Japanese word minshu, or the citizens, or the national, kokumin, national, or the imperial subjects. And so I'm trying to discuss the film audiences in relation to these social categories throughout film history from the 1920s until the present.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a really, really ambitious work. So I'm really struggling to make it a book. But I have already published some articles about this project. So hopefully I will complete this book in the near future.
Good.
Yeah. The other project is not so, this project is quite related to my previous book, this book about film stardom. So in this book, Making Personas, I deal with the, star. So the audience is a kind of in contrast with the stars, the receivers of the stars in the films, right? So I wanted to deal with the other aspect or other end point of the film. Yeah. And the other project is about the environment, the relationship between film and environment or ecology. So this is quite different project from Making Personal. Yeah.
Well, Hideaki, thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us. It's really been a pleasure, and best of luck with your new projects.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.